This is Dina Gregory. Today is July 3rd, 2016. I'm in Hudson, New York with the Hudson Oral History Archive. Today I'm interviewing Victor Gregory, better known as Chuck Gregory. He is my father. Chuck, can you introduce yourself, please?
Well, I'm exactly that. Chuck Gregory, better known as Victor Charles Gregory Jr., father of Dina Gregory, son of Victor.
Can you tell us where you come from?
I was born in Gannett, Pennsylvania, in the year 1929, June 20th, which was only about 4 months before the crash in Wall Street. That started my year off with my family. I was living in Gannett, Pennsylvania, and also living up in Hyde Park at my grandfather's house in Hyde Park. I stayed up there till I went into the first and second grade. I had a dog named Flip, a big German Shepherd with a cross of Shepherd and St. Bernard. And first day of school, the dog walked right into the classroom, which was two rooms, first, second, and third grade, then fourth, fifth, and sixth grade. And it was just a two-room schoolhouse. But on my first day of school, my dog Flip came in and sat right next to me in the classroom. So I had to get the dog out of there and take her home. And then the second day I was in grade school, I walked into the ladies' room, which was the outhouse of a girl's bat. It was the girl's outhouse, but I walked into it, you know. That raved a little hell. And I had a lot of friends up there. You want to hear any of the names of them? These are my close friends in Hyde Park. Was Eugene Manon, who lived next door. His older brother, built model airplanes that flew, you know, and they were Piper, whatever they were called. But in the meantime, he was in the Second World War, got killed in an airplane crash. He got with the Air Force, he got killed. But Eugene Manon was his name. And Freddie Cantaloupe, Junior Wolf, and a tomboy named Mary Ann. And she was tough as hell. She could beat the shit out of any one of us. That was the gang up in Hyde Park. Then one incident in Hyde Park that stands out to me was, I'm all about 7 years old, and I got this gang. This is my gang. In the meantime, we would go down to the creek, which ran below my grandfather's house. And I had the great idea to get these burlap bags that my grandfather used to keep sand in them to mix with cement. And I'd take the burlap bags with my guys, and we went down to the water, filled them up with the dirt, and put them across the creek, and it made the water deeper, probably about maybe 3 feet at best. And we'd go swimming in there, and this one day we're in there swimming, and it's the best, because I'm in the summertime there. And all of a sudden, I look at one of my friends, and he's got red all around him. And I thought, what the hell is that? And I looked at me, and I was all red. And my God, we ran out of there, because I ran up to the house, and we were bleeding with blood. And what it was, half a mile from where we were, was a slaughterhouse. And they would slaughter the animals, and then they'd flush out all the blood at one time. So we got all that blood all over, scared the hell out of us, you know. So that was some of the adventures up in Hyde Park. But had a lot of little adventures up there, but that was one of them. The same girl, one time, were up where the big hill behind my grandfather's house. That's where they had a lot of cows up in the hills. And they had like a bathtub, and they would keep dripping water in it, so it would give them water for the cows. And we'd go up and we'd be swimming in the bathtub, just jumping in the bathtub and cooling off. And that Mary Ann, the tomboy, she'd jump in with us. We would go in naked, but she wouldn't. But she said, I don't care, I got brothers. But she turned to be a beautiful girl. I saw her at one of the funerals back there years later. That's good for the moment. What's that? Am I supposed to be continuing here? All right, well then... Later, my mother always said during the Depression, she thought if my father could just make 20 bucks a week like he was making, she'd be very happy. 20 bucks a week. But there was one time we decided we're going to move to Baltimore, and my father's going to work for my grandfather at the National Bohemian Beer Company in Baltimore. So we got in his Model T, had a rumble seat in the back. I don't remember if my brother, yeah, my brother had me, he was a baby. So I was in a back seat. It was a seat that went down in the back. And it was with this old guy named Paul Stogowski. Don't ask me how I remember his name. But we were in the back freezing our ass off. We drove over the mountains over Route 40 going into Baltimore, which was about a five-hour trip. And then we're now, I never saw that guy again, but we're living in Baltimore and at 3106 East Baltimore Street. And at that neighborhood, I used to sell newspapers. I'd get a newspaper from a store, I'd get about three or four of them, and get on the streetcar. I'd pay, I think, 2 cents, 2 or 3 cents for the newspaper. And I'd get on the streetcar and go, paper, paper, newspaper, All American, Sun paper. And then I'd go down the aisle, and the guy'd stop me. And it's a 3 cent paper, but he'd give me a nickel. And I'd go, I don't have any change. Oh, you son. I said, okay, thank you very much. The only trouble is I'd get up to the other end of the streetcar and get off, and my newspapers were sold. So, hell, I had to go pay the full price to go back to where I was to get more newspapers. That was in East Baltimore. Then eventually we moved to East Baltimore again, near City Hospital, it was called, which was 318 Drew Street, D-R-E-W, Drew Street. And that's where I kind of grew up. And had friends like Johnny Davis, who is still around today. And we're both 87 years old. I just talked to him the other day. He's hanging in there pretty good. But we came close friends. We joined the Air Force together. He was a goof off in the Air Force. That's it for a while.
What was your role in the Air Force?
Well, I was opened up an Air Force base in Wichita Falls, Texas. It was never opened before because the Korean War was starting, so we opened it up. And then while I was there, I took care of all the entertainment at the Officers Club, and I was only going to basic. But this Norman F. Schaff took a liking to me, and he was in charge of special services and stuff. So I helped him open the Officers Club and got a band together, got all these girls that were the wives of the officers, and I got them put a chorus line together, and it was a big show over there, so it was a big deal. So anyway, the major, Major Shaw, he liked me, so like this one time, he asked me, you know, did I need anything? I said, yeah, I want to get the hell out of here and get out of this uniform. So he loaned me a suit, which was a tweed suit and had silk in the knees. So when you put the pants on, it didn't get stuck, or else it would put a bubble in the knee. And so I said, yeah. So he loaned me a suit. And I said, well, I want to have a day off to go to town. We were stuck in this base all day. Sorry, he gives me a pass. So I get Johnny Davis, my buddy, who drove. I never drove a car at that time. So he loaned me his car. I sat in the back seat. And when you go through the front gate, you have a pass. And they give him a pass. In the meantime, they see me in the back seat, and they salute me. And I'm just a private. But they salute the car. They don't really salute the man. They salute the car. So anyway, we went to town and went to this ranch of some girl that I had met on the base. Forgot what her name was. Lolita. Lolita was her name. Anyway, we spent the day there trying to ride horses and all that kind of stuff. And that was kind of the first mention of that. Later on, I did so well with this officer that I automatically went into special services in the Air Force, which was stationed in Roswell, New Mexico, 1948. 1947 is when they had the flying saucer or whatever they would call that thing. It came from outer space, supposedly, in 1947. I never saw anything. So that took care of that. And then later on, I spent it in Roswell, New Mexico, And then later I got transferred to England in 1951. I was in England until 1952. Went over in the USS Patch, which was a big ship. And my ex-wife, Elnora, came over to Queen Elizabeth. So that was a big deal for her. Well, I got you pretty up to date on that. Now, let's see, and then I was got out of the service, went to work for Pittsburgh Plate Glass and Company. I was a good salesman for them, too. Then I got in the record business. My ex-wife's aunt was in the music business. I met her, and there was an opening in the music business, so I took the job. I took a job with a record company. And I worked for them for a couple of years and then went to work directly for Columbia Records, with the Schwartz Brothers in Washington, and we had 20 different labels, you know, Atlantic Records, Warner Brothers, every damn thing. And then from there, I joined Columbia Records, which I liked. And I had the Baltimore, Washington area. And I had a lot of things happen during that time. But in the meantime, I just fast forwarded to, I got transferred to Hollywood, and I loved that. Be a promotion man in Hollywood for Columbia Records. I was there for about a year and a half, and then there was an opening in San Francisco, and I said, I'll take it, because I wanted to be in San Francisco. I didn't really like Hollywood. So I went to San Francisco and became the head of promotion there for Columbia Records. And during that period of time, I opened up a pressing plant and did all kinds of crazy things. I had this pressing plant. We were making 45 records. We'd make them for like, I think, 10 cents or 15 cents, whatever it was. It cost us about 4 cents to make one. And that was 2 cents for the labor and 2 cents for the plastic. But I'm trying to think now. Oh, I had this pressing plant. Now, I'm working for Columbia Records, and I'm running this little pressing plant on the side. And then it was pretty tough. You know, you got to have work to keep people busy, because I had these Mexican guys who would come up from Los Angeles, and I'd keep them upstairs in a loft with some beds up there, and they'd stay on all week, but you got to keep them busy so they make some money. So in the meantime, I had a phone in there. It was SF Audio Record Manufacturing. And then one day, the phone was called up. They were going to cut the phone off. I said, oh, Jesus, well, I owed money to the phone company, and I haven't got the money to keep the phone on. So I said, oh, I got an idea. So I call the phone company and I go, look, this is SF Audio down here on Bryant Street. And I said, I've got a phone here that's busy all the time, and these people want to keep using my phone. I don't want them to use it. Could you put in one of your pay phones? And I said, oh, yeah, we could put it in. So then I had a phone. It was a pay phone. So I had people call them up, say, got any orders? Call on my regular phone. So I had the pay phone in there for a while. And that was kind of funny. Think about it. That was damn funny. Trying some other. At the pressing plant, I'd get a guy from tax guy would come in. Hey, I want to see your books. Blah blah blah. And I go, you want to see my books? All right, just be right with you. So I got this basket with all these bills in and receipts in and all. And I said, here it is. He goes, what the hell are you talking about? I said, well, that's what I have. I don't have nothing. I don't have an accountant. This is it, you know. So anyway, he said, oh, so anyway, he just, somehow he left me go. And then it happened again. Another tax guy comes around. The same thing I did. Anyway, he went. Then one day, a sheriff comes in. He's going to collect. So he's going to lock the doors. So it's on a weekend. He said, he said, I'm closing the place up. Any money comes in, it's going to go to this bill I have to collect. So I said, okay. So I locked him in the place. I locked the door from the outside, and he was inside, so I locked the doors. He stayed there for a weekend, and he almost died. So anyway, I let him out on a Monday, and he was pretty mad, but I didn't have any trouble with him anymore. And then finally, with the pressing plant, I had another guy came in, a tax guy, and this guy was tough, and he said, I've been here. You had two other guys that came in and you drove them crazy. He says, but you're not going to drive me crazy. and says, I'm going to put you out of your misery. I said, what the hell are you talking about? Said, I'm going to put you out of your misery. I'm going to close you down because you're just hanging in and you should. And he did. He did close me down. And I had my guy, Henry Jones, that ran the plant. He said he's going to stay here 2 days more till he knows it's going to be closed. And meaning I gave up. And I said, I'm not coming back. I haven't got the. And it was tough. If I had a good night's sleep, I probably would have been able to keep it. But anyway, I let the plant go. And it went down the tubes. but collecting those bills was something. San Francisco was a good town. I worked for Columbia Records, and I had all kinds of things happen there with, you know, great artists working in the city there. Had some good friends, too. They've all passed away now, so that's about it from that standpoint. What else can we talk about? Well, put a zip on it and see what happens.
What were your best memories in San Francisco?
Oh, well, the Fairmont Hotel was a friend of mine ran the hotel, which was the famous hotel in San Francisco that during the earthquake, that was the only thing that stood up in the whole town. Susie Strauss, she passed away. But her and I were good buddies, and another woman named Alma Greer, and that was another good buddy, and we used to meet up at Enrico's and the Buena Vista for lunch all the time. I only went to lunch with people I liked. I never took just anybody to lunch. I only went to lunch with people I liked. Well, what else you want to hear now? All right. I go back to Baltimore and a thing. There was a promotion guy in San Francisco named Del Costello, and I had the Baltimore, Washington market. He had the San Francisco market. And he had this song that two guys wrote, I Left My Heart in San Francisco. So when Tony Bennett came to town, he was working the Venetian room in the Fairmont Hotel. And Del Costello, which did the same job in San Francisco as I was doing in Baltimore, took the song to him. And he liked it very much, so they were going to use it in the act at the Fairmont for the weekend. So anyway, they just sang it in as the act as part of the San Francisco thing. And they closed on Sunday night. And Monday morning, the branch started getting calls on I Left My Heart in San Francisco. So they said to Bennett, whenever you're in the studio, record that tune, and we'll order 20,000 for San Francisco alone, which made it worthwhile. So they never thought much about it. But then one day, Bennett's in the studio, and the piano player remembered it. And if you ever hear the song, it's just tink-a-tink-a-tink, just a simple little melody. And they recorded it. It was I Left My Heart in San Francisco. And they made the 20,000 just for San Francisco for Del Costello. And he got the record, and it was selling out there. It was selling. So anyway, I asked him, I says, send me a couple boxes, which is about 50 records. Send them to me, some 45. I'll see if I can get it played in Baltimore. So he sent it to me. I got it played in Baltimore like crazy at all the good music stations. Then I went to Washington, D.C. I owned the town over there and got it played over there. And all of a sudden, I'm selling the record in Baltimore, which meant a lot. So then we start saying, we've got orders for this record. So they start shipping it. And then finally, they shipped it on a national basis, and it became a big hit for Tony Bennett. Otherwise, it would have been just a local hit. That would have been the end of that. Of course, I got a lot of thank yous for that son of a bitch. You know, but anyhow, during those days, that was an exciting moment, you know, was having that happen. I had other records that happened like that. There was a song called Louie Louie, and it was out in the 60s when I was in San Francisco. And I had it out by Paul Revere and the Raiders. And it went to number one in San Francisco, no place else. Just there went to number one. And it stayed number one there for 6 months at least. And then finally, it was over with, and I asked the national promotion guy in New York, Thompson his name was, what an idiot. Anyway, I said, get this record released all over the country. It's a hit record. It's been number one in my market for a long time here. And he told me, you know, go jump in the lake or whatever. In the meantime, it was almost a year later, I got that record out again and re-released it in my own city in San Francisco, and son of a bitch starts selling again. So I called the guy. I said, hey, I've got a hit on this record. Start doing something with it, you know. In the meantime, he didn't, and a group called the Kingsmen recorded it. It became a number one record in the country, but it never became number one in San Francisco. I never let it get played. So that was the tale of that song, Louie Louie. And them son of bitches got the credit for it. So anyway, that's one of the tales of the record business. And second time, Tony Bennett had another career on his side because he wasn't doing too much at the time. It's a lot of other things, but I can't think of all of them right now. Why don't you cut me off for the moment?
What would you say is a career moment that you were the most proud of?
That was it. That was one of them. Now, there were lots of them, but that was one of them. The first day in the music business, of course, that was, you know, my... I had a hit record. I got the first day in the music business, I was able being responsible for a record by Roy Hamilton. And I'll Never Walk Alone, it was called. I was in this... it's too long of a story for that one. But anyway, that's it. Click. I don't know what we do. I've got nothing else to say here. Got my dog Flip. I'm in Hyde Park. I go to Baltimore, from Baltimore to here.
You want
to
tell me about your parents?
Oh, yeah. My mother, I had a brother. He's still alive. My brother, Ronald. And my father's Victor. My mother's name, Dina. And we moved to Baltimore. And my father went to work for my grandfather. Then later on, he went to work for Bethlehem Steel, which was a permanent job at the steel mill. He was a bricklayer, but he used to build the furnaces that made the steel. Both special people. My father was a gem. My mother was a little hard-ass, but I loved her, of course. But she always thought she was more brilliant than what she was, but that was her. And my father, just a sweetheart. Everybody loved him. And my brother, he was a good-looking kid. We're at St. Elizabeth, and my brother is making his first Holy Communion. And, of course, my mother's there. You know, we're all sitting in the pew, whatever. And then the thing is over, and they're having a procession. They're walking out of the school, church, St. Elizabeth's it was. So he's walking out with this whole group in this little white suit. My mother, of course, she had much confidence, overconfidence, she would say, my boy's the best-looking boy in the whole bunch. And this woman next to her goes, how dare you? I'll show you who's the best-looking boy. That one right there, he's the best-looking. And it just so happened to be my brother. And my mother said, I told you so. But that's the kind of, you know, confidence she had. I told you so. I go, oh, Jesus, my. She was a pain in the ass in a lot of cases, though. But she was all right. She had me convinced I was an idiot till I proved to myself I wasn't. But that's just who she was, you know. That was the Miller side of her. They were always kind of know-it-alls. I'm wondering now. That was a good day. That was an interesting day. Shall we go on from there? I don't know where to go from here. You're not asking me any questions. It's pertinent for me to open my big mouth and tell you about it. Let me think. I told you I got into the record business by mistake, just by accident. I was at a bar, and this aunt of my ex-wife, Eleanor, was in there with her boyfriend, and he was in the music business. And I was working for Pittsburgh Plate Glass and Company, selling paint and glass. And the guy that she was with was the distributor, and he owned the company. So he offered me, he says, why don't you go to work for it? I need a guy in Washington. And I go, really? All right, I'll go. What's the name of the company? He said, well, we have a lot of different labels. We have Atlantic Records and Sony Records and this record. And he says, and then we have Metro MGM. I said, "What's that?" He says, "Metro Goldwyn Mayer." I said, "Metro Goldwyn Mayer, man, that's the movies." I said, "Are you kidding?" And they got soundtracks and all that kind of stuff. I said, "Wow, I'd go to work for Metro Goldwyn Mayer." That was a day in the life of. All right, I can't do anymore. I can't think of anymore.
How did you get from San Francisco to New York?
Oh well, I was strictly in promotion. I was, you know, calling the radio stations with records and introducing the record to them and try to get it played, and you take it from there. Then I got offered a job to go back to Hollywood. I was in Hollywood, then to San Francisco, then was offered a job to go back to Hollywood to be head of artists and repertoire. I would be looking for acts to sign, that kind of thing. And during those days, that's when I discovered Sly and the Family Stone. And one of the big things that I left the company soon after that, but during the period in Los Angeles, I had a flute player named Paul Horn that I had signed to do like a jazz album. And he got very interested in going to Europe to the Taj Mahal. He was going to be studying with Maharishi in India about meditation and all that. So he was very interested in that. So Paul Horn, his name was. So anyway, I'd done one record with him called, I can't think of the name of it offhand, but it was incidental little jazz thing. And then he's going to go to Europe, to India, only he needed money to go. I said, "What the hell do you need?" And he says, "Well, I got to have at least $5,000. I'll be there a couple of months." I said, "Well, I'll get you the $5,000. I said, "Well, you were in there, record something while you're over there." So I got him an advance of $5,000. He goes to Europe. And while he's there, he goes into the Taj Mahal, the entrance of the thing. So he goes in there, and everybody's praying. And while he's in there, he pulls out his flute, had a golden flute. And he played in there, this beautiful hymns that he was playing. So this guy came over to him, who was the guard, and he says, "You can't do that. People were in here praying." He says, "Well, I'm playing to my God." And he went, "Oh, he says, come back tonight." So he came back tonight. That night, and then he recorded this album. It was a beautiful album. So he came back, and I never heard it. And I listened to it, and I said, "Geez, this thing is gorgeous." I said, "What are we going to call it?" He said, "No, we'll call it Inside." He took a close-up of his face, and we call the album Inside. So it'll be Inside the Taj Mahal and Inside his head. And that record, believe it or not, we put it out and had all these pictures of the Taj Mahal and the story of how he recorded there and the sounds on the record. It was a gorgeous, gorgeous record on the flute. In the meantime, he comes back with this thing, and I get transferred to, I go to New York to get another. No, I opened up a record company with Bob Mercy in Hollywood. So I left Columbia to go open up this record label. In the meantime, I get a call from this guy in New York. This is like 2 years later. Ernie Altshuler's name was. He was the head of artists and repertoire at that time. And he says, "I got this record, this album called Inside, and it's by a guy by the name of Paul Horn." I said, "Yeah, Paul Horn is a great jazz flute player. I signed him a year or so ago." He says, "Well," he says, "the record is now up to about 100,000. And that was a lot of records back in those days. That wasn't like today, you know, you go on television, you sell 13 million. So anyway, that record became the number one transmeditation album in the world, and that kicked his career off. Then he became the godfather of transmeditation, and he put out he just passed away this past year, but he put out many albums. And finally, in the last years, meaning from that was 1970s, early 70s, something, whatever it was, in the meantime, he calls me just before he passed away. He says, "You know, I realize that you're the guy that had me record that record in India. And I've had a career on that all my life, putting out all these albums." I go, "Right, send money, you schmuck." You know, he didn't do nothing. Anyway, he died too soon, but that was it. But if it wasn't for me, he wouldn't have had a career, you know. It's almost like Sly and the Family Stone, same thing. That's about it. I can't think of any more things here to say other than what? You're not asking me any questions.
You want to talk a little bit about your family?
Well, my family is you. Now, how I met your mother. I mean, I was working in New York, and I was living up in West 68th between Central Park West and Columbus. And I'd go to work. I'd go down West Side, and I'd get down to the corner, which was Columbus Circle, and I'd usually go down there, go around the circle, go get something to eat, because I was working in that. I was going down the street there to go do something or another. In the meantime, I hear this horn blow when I was in Columbus Circle, and it's a friend of mine in a limousine. Harry Escola, it was his name. And he called. He goes, "Hey, Chuck." And I go, "Hey, what the hell are you doing in there?" He says, "Oh, my friend owns a limo, and we have the same office, so I use the limo when I want." So I said, "What the hell are you doing?" I said, "Well," I said, "I just finished up my job with the European label." And I said, "I'm going to go back. I'm getting ready to go back, go to California." He says, "Holy hell." He says, "This is the Gulf and Western building right here in Columbus Circle. Why don't you go see Tony Martell? They're putting a whole new record company together up there." And I go, I don't go that, but I go, I said, "Yeah." And he has a radio, he has a telephone in the car. And I said, "God damn." So he calls over and gets a hold of Tony Martell, who was the president, on the phone. And he says, told him about me. And he said, "Tell him to come right over right now." And I says, "Right now?" I says, "Okay." So I shook hands with him. I said, "I'll see you later. Thank you." So I go up to the building on the 23rd floor, which was the office of Tony Martell, the president. And I go over there and I say, "Hey, Tony," because we had worked at Columbia Records together. He was in sales. I was in promotion and marketing. So in the meantime, we meet and we start talking. He says, "What are you doing?" He says, "I'm starting this whole record company here, Paramount Records. And you have a couple other labels with it, Blue Thumb and a couple another label." So anyway, he says, so we start talking. The more I talk, he says, "I'd like to come over, head up the promotion and marketing." I go, "How much money?" He tells me, he says, "Yeah, that sounds good." So there I was. I didn't go to California. I stayed right there, and I lived up West 68th Street and during that period of time. I meet a woman named Mary Ann, which was Mimi, Galati, her name was, and we got along just famously, and in the meantime, we end up getting married, and we get married, and I have a daughter named Dina. It all came from that Columbus Circle thing that stopped me in my tracks, and that's how Dina showed up in this world, or else I'd have probably been back in California doing some stupid thing. I don't know what I'd have done if I'd have gone back, but I was headed back to California, no question about it. And that Columbus Circle stopped me. And then one day in that same Columbus Circle, there's a men's shop owned across the street from the Gulf and Western building, which housed the famous music, Paramount Records. And I was a head of marketing, but I didn't have any real title. And on the top floor was a restaurant where only executives went. Because they had like 40 different companies in the whole building. But if you were a vice president, you could go upstairs and go to lunch and charge everything off. It was great. So in the meantime, I go see Tony Martell, the president, and I say, "Hey, I says, what I did was I went across the street and I got myself a new gray flannel suit, double-breasted suit, and it looked really sharp. And I was wearing strictly jeans in those days they were wearing. So I wore the suit. I went over and knocked on his door, and I went in. I said, he looked at me, he said, "What's going on?" I said, "Tony, I like to be eating upstairs in that top of the mart up top there, where it's the roof garden thing." I said, "But I can't go unless I'm a vice president." I said, "So why don't you make me a vice president?" He goes, "Okay, you're a vice president. All right, thank you, goodbye." And that was it. I became a vice president of Paramount. So that was that tale. But again, all that was in Columbus Circle, And then I was there for a good while. Anyway, that's about it. I can't think of anything else. Well, you're interviewing me, so what do you got to say? But there was a, you know, we had, you had a brother that, you know, didn't make it. He was 3-4 days, and then he had some kind of complications, and he didn't make it. And then we went to Baltimore and went to work on you. And that was about it, yeah. All right. Click. I don't know what to say here. You know, you got me stumped. I've been all through most of this stuff.
Well, talk about what it's like to be a dad.
I don't know, man. That's tough. You ain't easy. No, well, no, that's a whole nother story in itself. I got to think about that for a while. But no, I enjoyed it very much, you know. Your grandmother and your aunt were at our house most of the time you were growing up, and you became very close with them. And at that time, I was working in a city, so I'd you know, come home late, so I wouldn't see you all the time. But I'd see you all the time, you know. No, it was great. We had the dog Flip, at three German Shepherds, you growing up. You loved them all, especially Flip you loved. So did I. She was my special dog. I can't get back again. I'm getting wearing out here. I don't know what else to say. I could keep going, but I can, you know. So click it off. That's enough.
Keep going.
I don't know what else to be talking about. I told you, think growing up with my mother and father and then my brother and the prettiest guy in the church and the Paul Horn story about the Taj Mahal and then the record business, the record pressing plant, things like that. You know, they were all there. I'm still enjoying life. That's about it, though. I don't feel like talking anymore.
What do you do to enjoy life?
See you and make me nervous. You're going to go to South America. That's scaring the hell out of me. I get nervous with that. I did enjoy the time you were in South America and Central America. I used to mark it on the map, all the different cities you were in. And I think you saw that when you came home one time. They had a map with all the pins in it where you were in South America. So that was kind of fun. I enjoyed that, knowing where the hell you were. And then the time we went to Costa Rica, you and Joy was down there, two crazies. I didn't realize he was so crazy. We're both sisters. Costa Rica, that was about it. Yeah, I enjoyed that. That was great. Again, Zingo, I can't think of anything else. What are you waiting for there?
Who's been a really, like, influential person in your life? Someone you really looked up to?
Nobody. I can't think. My grandfather I liked, my mother's father, Tony Miller. He was kind of special. Used to sleep with him when I was a kid going back to Pennsylvania and staying at his place up in Hyde Park. And I would sleep in bed with him. And then, son of a bitch, he'd start snoring in the middle of the night, and then it would wake me up, so I'd just go, hey! I'd go, hey! And he'd go, what the hell? And he'd wake up, and I'd just go back to sleep again. But he was special. And a lot of people I liked. You know, when I was a kid, we used to live on Conklin Street in Baltimore, and on Saturdays, we would... My brother was, you know, he's 4 years younger than me, so I was about 10 years old. And we would go up about 4 blocks. You know, whatever, you know, just went, you know, walked up to the movie house. And I'd go in there on a Saturday, and hell, they had Buck Jones, Tom Mix, Cassidy, every cowboy you can think of we used to see. And then they had all the chapters of Flash Gordon, the Green Hornet, Captain Marvel. Then he would have the... Three Stooges comedies, Popeye, Jigs, all this kind of stuff. You know, we were there, hell, most of the morning. We go up at 10 o'clock in the morning. 10 o'clock at night, he and I were still in there running around. My mother had to come in and get us, rave some hell with us. You, Chucky, you in there? I go, yeah, I mean, here, leave me alone. But that way it was fun. That was growing up, you know. My brother, you know, we didn't spend a lot of time together, but he was going to grade school. I was going with him, and he was, you know, 4 years younger, so I didn't really was around him that much. But one time I took him to school, and this guy, the mole, we used to call him, he said something to my brother, and they got into an argument on the way to school. I said, go ahead. I said, fight him. If he gives you any bad time, I'll hit him. Anyway, Ronnie beat him up. I didn't really spend a hell of a lot of time with my brother. Would like to. But he calls me now. We stay in touch. Go on. Just ask me something else. Then it'll trigger something.
Has life gone the way you expected it would?
Yeah, no, I'm happy. I've been a happy guy. But I lost most of my friends. So, you know, what the hell? No, it didn't go because I didn't take care of business there for a while. I let this damn, whatever this thing is of it, taking it just let me go down financially, which I would like to have had, made life a lot simpler around here. That's the only thing that didn't go well. It was that last couple of years, just didn't go well. Although I enjoy it, but it didn't go well. And that's the way it goes, you know. I'm still here, so I beat my alternative, what the hell. You know, you haven't got much choice. Yes, I'm satisfied. Got two adopted kids, your brother, you know, Adam and Joy. I know they both love me, and I know you love me, so what the hell else you want for your money? You know, Jesus. All those things were good. Like hanging out with you and trying to make this radio career we have here. Hi, guys. This is Dina Gregory, Radio Luxembourg, or what the hell ever you wanted. Jesus. I think that's it, because I haven't got much more to say unless you have some very good questions. There's a pause in the air. Who is that?
This is Dina Gregory on July 3rd. I'm back with my dad, Chuck Gregory. So was there anything else that you wanted to share?
Yeah, I would like to share some of the things in the music business that happened that were highlights. I mentioned the thing about Paul Horn and the Taj Mahal and discovering Sly and the Family Stone. But there was one other time I had a party in San Francisco by a group called Moby Grape. And that was the first rock and roll group Columbia Record ever signed. I had them. And I had this party. I'm going to throw this party in San Francisco. And I found it's like a gym. It had a big walking thing around it up top, like where you would, you jog up there. And it was like a big gym. So I had this Moby Grape party, and we made hosts, things to put around your neck. And we had all this thing, and we had a big stage. And then hell, the people that showed up was, well, of course, Moby Grape, the ones that starred. Janis Joplin showed up. The Grateful Dead showed up. Dan Hicks and his Hot Licks. Just everybody that was anybody in San Francisco showed up. And we had these special little badges that people wore when they came in to, you know, identify the party. And it went so well that I had made a contact at the Flower Mart in San Francisco, and someone had ordered orchids, but they canceled the order. They couldn't fulfill it, so they were just going to go spoil. So this guy said, I'll sell you all the orchids for about $150, $200. I forgot what it was, but it was about $200 for all these orchids, and it was a ton of orchids. So anyway, that was during the days of the flower child. You know, they call them the flower children. So I got all these flowers, and I brought them up, and I put them up on the second floor above the floor itself. And then you had the stage here. So when Moby Grape was on, they're playing. And while all that was playing, I was up on the top of the balcony up there with a couple crony kids, and we threw all these orchids into the crowd from the top. That's what they call them, you know, flower child. Threw the orchids in there. And they went absolutely crazy. Only one guy slipped and broke his leg, and later on we had to pay for it. It cost plenty, the company did. But they went nuts. Anyway, It ended up in Rolling Stone, which was the rock and roll paper, Rolling Stone, still so big today. Rolling Stone put it down as the party of the century, of a rock and roll party for Moby Grape. And it was the Moby Grape party, which is, you know, still in under the archives of Rolling Stone's best parties ever thrown. And that was one of my claim to fame. And then and later on, when I met your mother, I had her quit the company she was working for, which was a record business, to go to work with me, to go to work with the record company, with the Carey Brothers, of which we started the South Soul label, the South Soul Records. It was a premier disco label, and she was the sales manager. I made her vice president of sales. And she had never done that before, but I knew she'd be good, and she was great. One time, we had a record on South Soul Orchestra. It was the first one we came out with, and we'd say, okay, and there was about 25 distributors. They had a Chicago distributor. He's going to take so many. This guy in New York will take so many, and this and this and that. In the meantime, the South Soul Records, she's calling Chicago. And I said, yeah, well, tell them good for maybe 12,000 albums. She said, 12,000? Because she's selling Bethlehem, a jazz label. And they're lucky they took 60 of a title. So anyway, she got on the phone, and she called Chicago, and she takes their first big call, and I said, okay, it's South Soul Records, get this big disco thing coming, blah, blah, blah. And in the meantime, the guy says, well, there's, you know, like 60 people. She says, 60? No. We have you down for 12,000. The guy said, 12,000? What, are you crazy? She said, we are paying for the shipments. We're paying, it's $12,000, 12,000 records, and that's what we're shipping, or else don't order any. So I said, all right, ship it to us. So we shipped 12,000 there. And, I mean, just tonnage all over the place. Baltimore, Washington, a whole ton of records. In the meantime, they did sell through, and it was the top disco album of the year. But that was how your mother broke in on sales. She told them 12,000, and her biggest order was 60 on anything. Anyway, she became the best sales guy they ever had. And then one time we're in Chicago, her and I, and the guy that owns the place, really sweet guy, tough Jewish guy, you know, Chicago was his turf. So he says, hey, Chuck, how you doing, blah, blah, blah. He says, hey, where's the boss? And I says, oh, he couldn't make it. He says, what are you talking about, he? I'm not talking about he, I'm talking about Mimi. Where the hell is Mimi? And I said, there she is. Oh, Christ. They treat her like gold out there, because they bought the 12,000, they bought another 12,000 on top of it, you know. So anyway, she was the star in sales. Good sales. Your mother was a good salesman on the phone. She was the best. And of course, we got married in our apartment up there on 68th Street. Adam and Joy, your brother and sister, they both came to the thing. They were just kids at the time. And West 68th. And we had some wedding there. It was really great. A little great apartment we had right in 60th. Oh. Should have kept that place. That's another one went wrong. West 68. You can't find an apartment on that street. None. Jesus. Anywho, that goes into that part. And then later, you know, South Soul, we did a lot of things over there. The disco business became big. We made the first 12-inch record over there, which was never done before. And we had the first one. I got a gold record in the other room there. It came finally after all these years. That's it now. I can't think of anything else. I'm getting tired.
All right. Well, thank you.
All right. Play something back so I can hear it.